New Zealanders want and deserve a transparent and comprehensive inquiry into the COVID-19 response. Not another whitewash. That's why RCR is bringing you a special segment aimed at examining the terms of reference, as well as what the country's best and brightest minds believe should be put on the table and why. The inquiry sessions will endeavour to unpack everything we already know and all the things we still don't know about how the COVID response was handled and what needs to be included in any new inquiry, so that New Zealanders can get answers, justice, and a future free from government overreach. Welcome to the Inquiry Sessions.
Welcome to another edition of the Inquiry Sessions here on Reality Check Radio. My name is Alistair Harding, and today, as part of our own RCR COVID inquiry, we're going to revisit the freedom protests of 2022. In particular, of course, the Freedom Convoy and the resulting village that sprung up on the streets and lawns surrounding our Parliament buildings in Wellington. Just last week, I was in Wellington with RCR co-founders Alia Bland and Claire Deakes as they presented Reality Check Radio's People's Terms to our Deputy Prime Minister, Winston Peters. And as we went through the day, I couldn't help but stop and in my mind take myself back to that time. I stood on the steps of Parliament and looked back and imagined the tents that the police and the government would have seen. We walked through the halls of Parliament, and at one point we found the doors that led to the balcony where the speakers that Trevor Mallard installed had blared out what must have been the special parliamentary Spotify playlist, a playlist that included children's tunes like Baby Shark, for instance, that they must play during Friday night drinks and farewell do's. And then I sat in the viewing gallery and I saw the chamber where the decision to not engage with the protesters was made. And I witnessed the behaviours of the MPs, including how one MP on the Labour bench was actually playing Candy Crush on her phone. And I know this is a long-winded introduction, but it's my way of saying that I saw the other side a little clearer last week. And I tried to imagine what the government and the people inside those buildings must have been thinking at the time, or playing on their phones. And so that's also why we're talking to Sue Gray and Alan Simmons today, because Sue, as you know, is an intrepid lawyer who risked her career to call out the excesses of the COVID era. And Alan is the founder of the Outdoors and Freedom Party that Sue co-leads. And together they've written a book called Freedom Village about the freedom protests of February 2022. And it's their way of attempting to tell the side of the story of what went on outside Parliament. So perhaps those inside Parliament might also get a clearer look at the other side as well. It's all part of the healing process, so that in the future, maybe we'll all understand ourselves a little bit better. So Sue and Alan are here with me today to talk about the book and its launch, and I welcome them now. Sue, Alan, welcome to the Inquiry Sessions.
Thanks, Alistair. It's a privilege, as always, to talk to you.
Thank you, Alistair. Lovely.
Okay, to start with, why did you want to write this book? What's the importance of committing this to paper?
Okay, Alistair, look, it was really simple. If we don't write the narrative, the government will write the narrative. And they already tried with that documentary Fire and Fury, which we all know was just an absolute fiction and a dreadful piece of work. And I just felt there we had so much information. Sue Gray is the most amazing person at gathering official information requests and information. And we had so much information that the people of New Zealand had no idea about. They this book's going to shock people for them to know some of what was going on in the background. But there was also another story which Sue tweaked out of so many people, and that was their own stories, the people who were there. And so it was Sue's idea to incorporate them into the book as well. But I started writing the book, and I got about 30,000 words into it, and then Sue said, "Well, hang on, what about this and that?" So we then did it as a collaborative venture, and the finished product is absolutely stunning. It's a spectacular book, and I think it's going to go through history because every word in the book is defendable.
And this is the way that you've put it together. You know, this is I have had a look at it, and I've actually had a sneak peek at it, and I've been able to write a review for you guys. And it's a really beautifully written book. It's a lot of people coming together to tell the story, just as the Freedom Village was a lot of people coming together to tell their stories.
Yeah, it was amazing writing the book, actually, because first Alan started, and then he asked me to write a bit, and then I started writing more, and we got the idea of bringing in other people's stories. And we were really proud of the way it was all coming together. It was great, and everybody, almost everybody we asked, was really enthusiastic about helping, which was fantastic. And then sometimes I'd wake up in the morning with a bit of a panic attack and think, oh, gosh, we haven't covered a particular issue. And then within sort of half an hour, somebody would just contact me and say, hey, I heard you're writing a book. Do you want me to write about blah, 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 which was almost always exactly what I'd been thinking we needed. And it just happened like that over and over again, over and over. It was just so incredible. There's some magic to this.
And if we talk about the magic, let's go right back to the very beginning, to the day of the convoy. I know the story, but could you tell our listeners the story of how you guys came to be at Parliament? You hadn't planned to be there, I understand.
Not at all. I'd been up at Allen's because we were on our way up to another hui up north in North Waikato. And then we heard about the convoy, and it was quite bad weather, and we thought, oh, it was all going to be trucks, and we didn't have a truck, and we didn't really know much about it, but we sort of had a bit of a look and thought, oh, it's going not too far away, we'll go and have a look. And we basically jumped in the van to go and have a look, and then we just went, wow, this is amazing, and we just joined in, and 23 days later or whatever it was, we were still there, apart from just the few days when we had to leave. It was just like the Pied Piper, that you sort of couldn't not be there somehow.
Alan, what were your thoughts of that day, the convoy, those couple of days?
Yes, it really changed our lives that particular day, the decision to go to Taupo. And we couldn't believe the crowds that were turned out in the pouring rain, and we're going, what? And then I think the thing that really stunned me was the public perception all the way down, or the public support all the way down the highway. We went across to Napier, the convoy, and then right through the Hawke's Bay. And I mean, wherever there was even like a farm track came out onto the main road, there was a bike and a whole family and umbrellas standing there waving it on. Places like Waipawa, Waipakarau, Downieverk, you could hardly get down the road. Woodville was packed because they'd all come up from the Wairarapa. And people were running around handing food in the windows and coffee. And I'd just never seen such a outpouring of support from people. I mean, the Queen would never have got that sort of visitation and support on the side of the roads like the convoy did.
I remember that day thinking something very similar. I was thinking about, you know, what if the All Blacks came home with the World Cup? I doubt they would have got such a welcome that the convoy got that day. In particular, I also remember, you mentioned Woodville, that was a big one, but also Palmerston North, mm-hmm. coming into that industrial estate. It was quite incredible, wasn't it? And it never got covered by the media in any meaningful way. And so that's why I think this book that you've written is going to become more and more important as years go by.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping, because there were so many important stories, and there's a lot of overlap in the sense that most people that wrote a story for the book said the same thing. They didn't really know how they got there. They just knew that they had to be there. But then everybody's got their own perspective on it. And it's just so beautiful hearing how all these things happened that we didn't know about. Like, you know, we thought we knew what was going on, but there was layers and layers and layers of people doing all sorts of things and finding something that needed to be done and just organizing a group and just doing it. And a lot of those people have told these stories for the book as well. So it's so cool when you find out all those things, and it's like just like wow, just human ingenuity and human goodwill and the love and the cooperation, and that whole contrast between how it felt for us being at the village and how it was being portrayed in the media as this awful bad thing. You know, it felt like this kind of this tug of war that we were in between, you know, between truth and freedom on the one hand and sort of tyranny on the other hand.
Alistair, I think the one thing that really illustrated it to me was when this police inspector, I think he was pretty high ranked, came up to me on Aiken Street, said, we want to clear Aiken Street. And I said, no, that isn't going to happen, because I knew very well they wanted to come down there with their troops. And he said, well, you'll never get your toilets emptied again. And at that point, that was the end of the toilets being emptied. The trucks couldn't get in. And so, you know, suddenly there was a very industrious organisation between all the plumbers and builders. And what stood out for me was going past our van up Aiken Street with sheets of plywood. It was like those leaf cutter ants that you see on TV carrying a leaf. And people were carrying sheets of plywood and toilet seats and that. And within a day, we had the most brilliant flushing toilets going. And that was the cooperation that was happening amongst people. I just found that so energizing for me as a person to see that. But also, of course, it was so funny how the bureaucracy tried to react to it. Like, they tried to tell Wellington that all the sewage and stuff from the village is being flushed into Wellington Harbour. But, of course, so the boys pulled the top off the sewage main and stuck all the stuff into the sewage. Wow, what a performance. You're pumping sewage without a consent. I mean, oh, for goodness sake.
You're pumping sewage into sewage. How outrageous.
Without the consent.
Tell me, the people who were there, everybody took their little part that they played and they got into doing that. But behind the scenes, there was a lot happening, and I believe that you were both involved in those discussions, trying to influence what happened with the protest. Does this book tell that story of behind the scenes as well?
It tells as much as we knew. I didn't directly talk to the police, but we've certainly got people who were involved with the Human Rights Commissioner. I was involved helping people with the court process. There's a lot of behind the scenes stories. I was writing official information requests and complaints to the police commissioner, the Independent Police Complaints Authority, to Trevor Mallard, who even used to reply to me very occasionally, never very constructively, but at least he did reply, unlike the others. So we've tried to include as much of that kind of thing as we can, yeah.
What sort of communication was being had with Trevor Mallard? That's the first I've actually heard of that.
Oh, well, I was emailing them, telling them that they were acting unlawfully and that they needed to research trespass law and read their own information on the parliamentary website that said that Parliament was a place for protests. And it was the place. The court had said that it was the place to come. And he can't make his rules override fundamental rights and freedoms. So, you know, I was sending a lot of information. I was also writing to the police complaints, police commissioner, because he went on the media and said, if we go into Parliament to close this down, people will be injured. And so I always assumed that that meant that they wouldn't go in because their job is to keep the peace, not to injure people. And so it really, really shocked me that the police took the view that actually it was okay to go and assault people and smash up private property and do whatever they wanted because somehow the ends were more important than, you know, ending that protest was the most important thing. And, you know, I was doing a lot of research and emails, writing to them, doing whatever I could during the protest and afterwards.
And Alistair, I think in the book we show things like Trevor's response emails to Sue, which are pretty shocking from the Speaker of the House or the Member of Parliament. What did he say to you? Sue, you need to get a decent lawyer.
Need to get a lawyer. and the trespass notice that somebody gave me that they'd put him down, it was signed on behalf of Trevor Mallard.
Yeah.
So, you know, the police had a lot of problems with their trespass notices anyway. They pretty much all got thrown out of the court because they didn't follow, first of all, They had no right, in my view, to issue trespass notices. But when they did do it, they didn't follow proper process and they were giving all sorts of conflicting information. But then the notices that they gave didn't even have a proper person's name signing them. And so it's quite funny when you put it all together. I mean, it's one of the things we sort of thought in the book, you know, we were sitting in the camper van trying to make sense of the situation and keep up with what was going on and provide whatever support we could provide to people. And we pretty much called it right. And yet the force of the might of government, with all of the staff sitting in their flash offices, sitting in the Parliament building, they got it so, so wrong.
Could I just say this, Alistair, that it was really interesting that we got wind, of course, as you may recall, where the Prime Minister of England was using WhatsApp to avoid personal information requests. Anyway, so quickly whacked off a Official Information Act request for the WhatsApp messages from the Prime Minister. And we got them, and so they're in the book. And of course, the police commissioner, the police commissioner, advised her on WhatsApp that the protest was legal and that they couldn't do anything about it. We've got that in the book.
That exchange itself is a reason to buy it and read it. But this is the thing about this book that it made me think. The conclusion I came to when I looked at it is that this story hasn't been told by the mainstream media, so therefore it's just so important that it is down in print now. And in the absence of any meaningful description of what really happened from the protesters' point of view, this book will become the source material for future historians, won't it? And one of those stories, Alan, the reason you started this was because you felt that your story of being injured and bashed by the police just wasn't told. Can you tell us what happened to you? This we're talking about on March the 2nd, aren't we, on the final day of the protest?
Yes. Well, according to the police integrity unit who wrote to me, it was my fault for being there, apparently. But basically, we heard the noise of the helicopters, and we had a fair idea it was happening. So we got out of the van and walked up Aiken Street, and I stood on the corner there by the Cathedral of Hill Street. They were all coming down in a line, yelling "Move, move, move!" with their torches, because it was dark then, and their riot shields and helmets and stuff like that. And somehow, I got booted, and I'm sure I got booted from behind, and that's the evidence I've given, into sort of the road, and right in front of them, and then I got smacked by a shield right across the length of my body. It hit my face mostly. It really hurt. I was surprised how hard those shields were. And then the second one knocked me to the ground. And then they walked over the top of me. It was still dark, but it got darker with all these policemen walking over me. And to cut a long story short, I hip-hopped my way down, and I actually saw you filming where I tried to sit down, and I was in great pain. And then they sent some medics up who took me down to the tent, and we rang 111 because they said I had probably had a broken hip. And then they wheeled me down to the railway station. We sat there for 4 hours waiting for an ambulance. The ambulance was, oh, it was dreadful. All that's in the book. And then...
And when you said, Alan, that they wheeled you to the medics, the people wheeled you to the medics. The police did nothing. They had all those green-dressed paramedics who did not one thing to help, even after I was asking them to help you.
Yes. Yep.
That was part of how horrible that day was.
Yeah. Right. So, as you know, Alistair, you covered the battle, you might call it. And it was riot police with helmets and batons and capsicum spray, and people standing there with their backs to them in jandals and shorts. And it was a pretty unequal battle, really. And
one of the things that I keep hearing from people who were not there, who have saw the story through the eyes of the mainstream media, I keep getting this comment back that, you know, the protest may have started with good intentions, but some bad people got involved and it all spiraled downwards from there. That's not what I remember. What I remember was that it was a very peaceful gathering, people doing speeches and singing songs and having hug breaks. And the only time anything happened that went wrong, it was the police coming in and throwing their weight around, so to speak. What is the story the book tells about the peacefulness or the violence of the whole occasion?
Definitely, as you say, Alistair, that it was just a beautiful vibe most of the time. It was like being at a lovely festival, and it was amazing because we'd been told two jabs for summer and you can't have a summer. Well, we had the best festival in New Zealand on Parliament grounds, and people were there in a great spirit, and like you said, except when the police came. And the only exception to that, I would say, is on the last day, I believe a different group, third group came in. So we had the protesters, we had the police, and then we had a third group of, let's call them troublemakers, who arrived. And why they arrived, we don't know. But there are quite a few video shots of the black masked people coming across the face of Parliament grounds and bringing little backpacks with gear. And we've got quite a few stories in the book of people's experiences with those people. So, yeah, I think it's a really important thing that's never really been covered by the media at all, that third group. And who were they? What were they doing? And why did we get the blame for it?
Yes, I actually named them a bit, but I took the name out, actually, for the, you know, we don't want to get the book shut down by, you know, legal stuff and that. We want the story to be told. But there is pictures in the book of them carrying little red petrol cans and pouring the petrol into the tents and setting fire to them and stuff like that. And all that's in the book. And I don't know where we got, I cut and pasted a lot of that out of the videos because some of those videos have been shared so many times, I don't know even who had the videos or who took them. But that's all that evidence is there. And we have a fair idea. They all came from the railway station. They were seen walking from the railway station. And I've got a picture of them all coming up the steps into the Parliament grounds with their backpacks and their masks and goggles. They had goggles on and they had New Zealand flags wrapped around their faces and goggles and helmets. And they were dressed in black and had backpacks on and carrying rocks and petrol and stuff like that. So all that's in the book.
Alan, is it becoming easier to talk about this subject, or is the temperature still very high? How do you feel about it?
No, I think it's the right time. One of the things the police, Independent Police Complaints Authority highlighted was that this huge loss of trust in the police. And that hasn't got any better at the moment. People are really scathing about the police. And so I feel that this will clear the air a wee bit, because I know quite a lot of police who actually left the police force or were disgusted with their own operation. And as Sue said, we need to get the story out there now, because, you know, it's the old it's the old story, isn't it? First in, best dressed sort of thing. And the government tried it with their Fire and Fury documentary, but a book detailing everybody's history and everybody's stories is going to be a lot more long-lasting in terms of people of history. And the beauty about it is people can pick it up and read it at will.
Okay, so speaking of the book, have you got any favourite parts, both?
I kind of like all of it because of the different stories that we hadn't heard before. But I love just the stories. Oh, I love the story from the wee girl, the mother and the wee girl at the Picton camp. That's just a beautiful story, how they went to help and the wee four-year-old was just so going through everything that the people at the Freedom Camp would need and how they could help all those people stand up for freedom. I thought that was a really beautiful story. I love the story of Sunshine, who at 78 years old decided that she needed to go. She hitchhiked over from Golden Bay to Picton and got herself over to the Freedom Village and joined in there and helped out at the massages and the health tents. You know, the people that Sue Harris and the teams that set up to make the food, the logistics behind this, the scenes of that is just phenomenal. What the effort those people went to. And, you know, Fiona organising, admin. I mean, there's just so many stories. I think it's honestly the type of book that you can come back to it so many times and just read it, read a few heartwarming stories of human cooperation and determination to make a difference. It's you can read it. I mean, when we've been trying to edit it, it's been really... Well, I've been trying to do all my other work and edit the book. And every time I start reading the book to edit it, I can't stop because it just draws you into it. So I hope other people have the same experience.
I just want to say, Alistair, my favourite story basically is the whole book because it shows what humans can do if they're left alone to help themselves and organise things. I have great faith that if there was a nuclear war and we were left here on our own, we could actually come up with a pretty good society of everybody working together. But the funniest one that got me was that nobody could get across the Cook Strait from the South Island convoy because of the mandates. You had to have a vaccine pass to come across on the ferry. So they set up the freedom ship, the freedom boat, and it was trundling backwards and forwards between Picton and Wellington, bringing people across. I thought that was hilarious. So it doesn't matter what they came up with. Everybody found a way around it. I've got a picture of the freedom boat in there, steaming across to Wellington. And, yeah, it's hilarious.
That story somehow transports me each time back to a much simpler time in New Zealand. It almost doesn't seem like it fitted in 2022, that it fitted more like in 1993 or 1985.
Yeah, back to the old number 8 wire mentality. That's what I like. Like Alan said, it shows that we've still got it in us. It might have been a bit suppressed, but we've got our creativity and our intuition. We've got everything there just waiting to be used. Just get the bureaucrats out of the way and the people are amazing.
Okay, so launch is this Thursday, the 16th, in Wellington. Have you got a place? Where can people go to be part of the launch and get the advanced copies?
We're meeting at Backbenches at 5 o'clock. We've actually in court that day on the fluoride case, so we'll court should be finished by 5. If it's not finished by 5, I'll be there maybe a little bit late, but everyone else is invited to meet at 5 and we'll go from there.
So 5 p.m. Thursday the 16th at the Backbencher Pub. If you get there early, go along and support at the High Court for the fluoride case, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be great.
Okay, but if people can't make it on Thursday, it's also available to buy on the internet. Can you tell us how people can get hold of their copy?
Yes, it's www, the usual W's, freedomvillagebook.com.
www.freedomvillagebook.com.
Correct, yep.
And how much are they being sold for on there?
Basically, it's $35 plus GST, plus postage and packaging.
We're also planning a quick mini tour of as many places as we can over the next probably 10 days or so, just so that we can get to Tauranga, Auckland, Nelson, Christchurch, and hopefully Picton and maybe a few other places, just so that people can meet us and have a talk about it. And also we've got a few people that have got shops who are very freedom-minded, and they're offering to sell them through their shops, through some of the cafes and different shops. So we're just working on how we can do that at the moment as well.
And do you have those dates confirmed yet, or do people just go to the website to find out where and when?
Best to go to the website, because we're just developing it as we go, trying to work out how we can do it, because we don't quite know how many books we can get quick enough.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for both joining us today for the inquiry sessions. That, I mean, as I said, I think this is going to be the source material for future historians, because the media and the government haven't done anything towards telling the stories. And I guess this is just the start of people being able to tell that story. And so thank you so much for making the effort to do it both. And also, you know, for being there and putting your professional reputations on the line at the time. I mean, Sue, your business as a lawyer, you put it on the line. And likewise, Alan, with your political party. It was a big thing for people to see you guys standing there alongside them during that very tumultuous period.
Thanks, Alistair. It was kind of one of those things where we didn't really feel there was any choice. Sometimes you just have to do things, and would you change it? Well, you'd change Alan getting a fractured hip, but you wouldn't really change anything else. It was amazing to be part of history.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much both for joining us today on the inquiry sessions.
Bye-bye.
Oh, thank you.
Keeping the COVID inquiry honest, it's time for the inquiry sessions.